we are all about sharing new ideas at the Shift Extension. But why not share a cup of coffee? That creamy little cup of magic that just makes everything better. I love coffee, so I've been roasting fresh beans right here in Brisbane, and I'd love to share them with you. So we've created two great flavors to fuel your next shift. If you're a member of our Patreon, we'll give you 20% off any order. So head over to www.shiftycoffee.com.au and grab your first bag today. Can training replace experience? Ooh, what do you got?
How many Freddos do you have?
4, 5, 6.
Poppin' candy.
So good.
I promised my wife.
No, don't. Shelly.
Hundreds and thousands. Let me just...
Lou, if I can't keep a small promise to her...
Exactly.
Big ones don't matter.
Exactly.
I don't need a Freddo.
No, you don't.
Damn it.
Debatable.
No, I don't.
It's a bad batch.
Sonny.
No, it's not. Don't tell him that.
I hope he chokes on him.
Me too. We don't know what to do, though.
It's so creamy.
Just leave him.
It's really actually not good. Should be cold.
Lou.
Chocolate.
Yes.
Why
are people so scared to publish things from students, parents? Why are people so scared to publish?
Do you know that
one? I think there's a bit of ego.
Where's the fear come from?
They don't have PhDs, firstly. So what would they know about it?
But even publishing in the Shift Extension, we get some really good articles sometimes and then they get rescinded because their university staff have said no. Where does that fear come from? Because publishing law and university policy both support the students being able to submit what they want for publishing. Oh, why is this happening?
It's a great question.
Are you encouraged to publish things? Not really. Isn't that interesting? There's like 2,000 paramedic students in the country publishing awesome assignments on all kinds of topics.
Is there a database for them?
They never see the light of day.
What?
Because, I mean, the students own the copyright to their own work.
Do they?
You look at most of the university policies out there, students own their own work. So you've got all of this amazing work being done and it never sees the light of day because people are not only just not encouraged to publish, they're actively discouraged.
We're not just talking about undergraduate students. We're talking about postgrad.
I was referring to undergrad for this, but you are right, postgrad as well. Postgrad come into a different realm though because a lot of postgrad work is research-based and going to academic journals. But there's a lot of amazing work being done just through basic reports or literature reviews or things that by undergrad students who are investigating certain areas of our practice and then their work never sees a light of day. And it's because they're not just not encouraged, they're actually actively scared away from submitting things.
But why?
I know, that's what I'm asking.
I won an award once for a report.
Did you?
Did we publish it?
Did we publish it or who did?
No.
Who did?
Oh, why not?
Who published it?
No, we've got to encourage it. You got to encourage.
What was it about?
Sepsis. Identifying sepsis using screening tools.
Well, where did you publish it?
It's not published. I'm just letting you guys know I won an award.
Yeah.
I just want you to know.
Well, can we give us your award-winning paper and we will
then we can say the, award-winning.
We will put it through the editorial process.
Okay.
We'll reject it.
Boost my ego.
Like, award-winning? What?
We have an editorial board who review things, and we are archived in the National Library of Australia under an ISSN, so it is as legitimate as publishing law.
What does that mean?
Yeah, what's an ISSN?
It will exist forever.
Is that
ever?
If we
shut down the magazine, the National Library of Australia will retain copies of everything we've published.
Oh, I don't like
that. No, that's good. That's history.
I should start. Okay.
That's the purpose of publishing is it's out there for people.
Mm. What if you change your mind?
So is that why students don't? Is that why paramedics don't? It's scary.
Mm. Mm.
So is it scary to expose themselves? Mm. Why? We do that every week on this podcast. We get criticised.
Imposter syndrome.
We've talked about that.
Yeah, we have.
We all suffer.
I think it's easy to have ideas behind closed walls or share your honest opinions within a small group of people that you trust, it's much harder to get it out there to the public.
The only feedback that they're encouraged to give is through anonymous surveys at the end of a semester.
Formal. That's the formal way of doing it.
So why are people scared to publish their work? Why are they actively discouraged from publishing their work?
Don't know.
Do they even know that they can? Like, is
well, that's another good question. Yeah. Maybe
we should write to all the heads of school across undergraduate and postgraduate courses and say, hey, send us your best assignments and we'll publish them.
Mm. I'll send you mine.
I don't think they would support it. Again, why because not? Of fear of being exposed. Like this fear that the students or qualified paramedics have is given to them somewhere. And I think it's from potentially people above them not understanding the structures. And so it's easier to.
We're just putting it on the internet.
Yeah. Like, how do you go
with it? Put worse things on the internet.
This is very true.
Everyone publishes on social media every week.
Yeah.
But then you talk about publishing and suddenly they're.
Mm.
Like, it's all just content.
Mm.
Just curious, because we literally had a really, really powerful report sent in for publishing recently.
Mm-hmm.
And within 4 weeks of receiving it, we received an email from this student saying, oh, I need to remove it immediately. My head of department is really unhappy that I've done that. We said to them, look, we will happily do that. We're not here to upset anyone. We're not here to own anything. See, everything we publish under Creative Commons law as well, meaning that the writer retains the copyright. We don't.
Mm-hmm.
But there's so much fear in the student putting them from the head of department of their paramedic degree that it was just, it actually goes against the university policy where they're studying, because we looked up the university, we looked up their policy, and the students own their own work and can do what they want with it. It's an interesting conversation. Again, it comes back to what we were just talking about earlier in the podcast last week about leadership.
Mm-hmm.
There are good versions of leadership and some very poor ones, and the poor ones often come from a lack of understanding. Nick, what are we talking about?
We are talking about training and experience. I was on LinkedIn the other day.
Uh-oh.
Do you like LinkedIn?
There's lots of catchwords. I've participated in LinkedIn, and I've got all of these fancy little post-nominals after my name because
you have a lot of letters after your name.
It makes you look more.
If I had my phone, I'd
academic.
Check it.
Oh, I could tell you.
FRGCFTLA.
It is supposed to be a repository of online CVs and people sharing their work, but it's. Well, I guess it is. What do you think of LinkedIn?
Look. I think there's some positives to LinkedIn. I've certainly met some interesting people on there and created some good networks.
Have you had any opportunities?
LinkedIn's different for paramedics than for other industries. Like, I have mates that work in recruitment and engineering and marketing. They get their jobs from LinkedIn. People will headhunt them.
Mm.
And my mate who works in recruiting, he'll hunt people almost exclusively through LinkedIn. So it can be quite powerful in other industries. I don't think it's quite there yet in paramedicine, but
why not?
Don't know.
I've had a couple of jobs come through LinkedIn.
Have you got them?
The irony here is they are from other industries looking for paramedics in certain outside of the truck spaces, Lou.
Yeah.
Cool.
So I think it's a good place to go to see what's happening around the world. Mm. It's a good place to see what conversations are happening and what's topical. Mm. We find some of the our podcast discussions and topics from LinkedIn, and today's discussion is from a post on LinkedIn that I saw, and I wanted to get your perspective on things. It was a post around experience, and it was not just the post. It was more about a comment made from someone, and essentially that person was saying that in order to be a good paramedic, a competent paramedic, you need to have a level of exposure and experience. You need to go and work somewhere where there's lots of patients so you can get experience so you can be good. And unless you're doing that, you're not a good paramedic. And I wholeheartedly disagreed with what this person was saying. It made me curious. Do you think that working in an area that is busy, where you see lots of patients, do you think it's a right or something that should happen? Or do you think it's a privilege? Because to provide care to the community, paramedics need to work in a variety of locations. Some are very busy metropolitan locations. Some are very remote locations. And in order to provide care to everyone, we need to have paramedics that work in areas where they're not going to see many patients at all.
Is this an issue around skills degradation?
There's two issues.
Is that the right word?
What is that? Skills degradation?
Well, is that the right word?
Yes.
Skills decline.
Oh, degradation. Yeah, they degrade.
Okay.
Well, I think there's two things. One is still skill degradation, where you maybe had some experience and you were, you know, so, to put it one way, on top of your game.
Mm-hmm.
And then you went somewhere and it got a bit slow and you weren't as sharp as you used to. Or the other issue is you go there and you've never seen stuff before and you have no reference. So my question is, are we looking at things incorrectly by saying to people you need to have exposure to be competent?
Well, two things. One, I think that comes from an egotistical place. And two, I think it comes from a place of fear. So I wholeheartedly disagree with it as well. Now, why I say it comes from an egotistical place is because they're looking at that from their perch, from a very biased perspective. Obviously, they are somewhere that gets a lot of exposure, right? Now, what is exposure? What does that translate to? How is that defined? Lou, you've worked in regional and metropolitan areas.
I've done placement.
Yeah,
yes.
That's working.
Correct. Yes.
That's working.
Sure. Yep.
That's providing care to the communities.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Where did you get the best experience for you? I'm curious. Metropolitan or regional?
Regional.
What? Straight up. Right.
What?
Now, I knew that was going to be the case.
Yeah.
I knew that was going to be the case because my own experience when I was going through my own studentship was I had far better experiences in regional areas than metropolitan. So I want to ask Lou why, to see if we match up here. Why did you have a better experience in a regional area than a metropolitan one that was busier?
I think it's multifaceted, really. Because in regional areas, there's less access to like specialist healthcare. So comorbidities can occur. There's more paramedics in metro areas, correct?
I agree with both your statements. One is it's a numbers game.
Yeah.
In most regional areas, you can have populations 50, 60, 70,000 that are only served by a couple crews, as opposed to a city that's served by a couple hundred.
Yes.
So although you're busier in a city, you're not getting the same exposure. And so by far my best clinical experiences were from regional areas because of a simple numbers game.
Yep.
Now, that also translates to your first point. I made it my second point, is that because there are less resources in regional areas, people have been, in quotation marks, suffering for longer or living with things that potentially they wouldn't be in cities. Now, that's also coming from a reasonably, you know, biased subjective place, but that was also my experience. You would see things that have progressed much further. And because there's more prevalence of those and because there's less crews, you'll go to more of those. Therefore, for me, I gained more clinical exposure in regional areas. So I disagree wholeheartedly with you must be somewhere that's busy to maintain skills. When I moved to a metropolitan area years ago, it took me 18 months to get clinically challenged by a case, having been in a regional area for 5 years.
We go back to that question of what is experience? Is that there a line in the sand where you've had enough experience to be competent? And I think traditionally we say, here's the traditional concept of, you leave a jurisdictional ambulance service and therefore you're not a real paramedic anymore because you somehow.
Not even you've left an ambulance service, you've never worked for one.
But do you think part of that point is because jurisdictional ambulance services, or the concept, is that jurisdictional ambulance services see more patients, therefore you get more experience and exposure? Like your colleagues, do you think the next generation of clinicians want to work for an ambulance service because they see more patients and there's more exposure there, or for other reasons?
I think that's the main reason.
Seeing more patients.
To get exposure. Is that just the buzzword going around? Is it the exposure?
But it also comes from an ignorant place that they don't know what else is out there. They're not taught.
If we can't define exposure, then why are we so worried about it?
Mm-hmm.
Ooh. That's a great question. Circling back really quickly to the other part of this, right? Because we're talking about exposure. Lack of exposure leads to skills decline, skills degradation, whatever you want to call it. I literally had a conversation with someone about this yesterday on a film set. I won't name them. Let's call her Jill. Jill was concerned because she's never worked for an ambulance service. She's applied and she's been waiting. And so she's been filling her time working on film sets and working in events. And she feels like she has suffered from skills decline, and she was asking me how I maintain my skills, and asked her specifically what skills does she think she's lost. And the first things that she raised immediately were drugs, because they don't have the same access to drugs in the private sector that you do in ambulance services with the dispensations and things like that. And I found that a really interesting, almost mute point from my perspective, because so many people have been brought up with ambulance kits in paramedic education that they think that that's what a paramedic is. So even I've been laughed at because I'm not carrying morphine. I've been laughed at by my own colleagues. Yeah, but you're not doing real paramedic work. You're not even carrying S8s. Where does it stipulate in your upper registration that to be a registered paramedic, you have to carry S8s? It doesn't. So if you can't access them, but you're still working as a registered paramedic, we've actually trained you inappropriately for where paramedics are going to be working. So if you've lost a skill that you're taught at uni, or you've lost a skill that you're using in a previous job that's now not applicable to the new job that you're working as a paramedic, it's not a skills decline at all. It's a different environment where you actually don't need that. Mm-hmm. It'd be like an airline pilot being concerned that they can't fly a Cessna, or someone who's retired from that can't fly a Boeing. I think there's too much emphasis on people's notion of what a paramedic is and should have.
Like if a pilot gets into a Cessna, and they've come from an Airbus, and the Cessna doesn't have autopilot, they're still a pilot.
Mm-hmm. I think the startup procedure is going to be different too. They might not even be able to get the Cessna off the ground. Does it mean they're not a pilot?
Correct.
Mm. So there's too much emphasis over people's biased perspectives of what a paramedic is when we're even talking about these kinds of... I mean, the original question was, can training replace experience? But we can't even answer that question without delving into, well, what is experience? Mm-hmm. And then what is exposure?
Mm-hmm. And I think there's a bit of ego to it, because you see this, you know, people go, oh, I went to this traumatic arrest, and they wear it like a badge of honor.
Bullshit. I bet they didn't go to
Why would you want to wear that as a badge of honor, though?
Or like they, this whole like, I'm a shit magnet. I think the whole I'm a shit magnet thing is just a whole utter bunch of crap.
I love trauma.
It's just rubbish. It's just people's biased opinions of their levels of exposure. And I think we all this idea of, oh, I haven't got a real patient today because they weren't sick. It's utter crap. And we need to get away from this concept of, you know, I'm not a real paramedic unless I'm going to high acuity jobs. It's silly.
The notion of you're going to lose your skills in a regional or remote area compared to a metropolitan one is a misnomer, because the amount of non-acute... Here we go.
Here's a question. You're not losing skills, you're getting new skills.
Mm. Well, this was a discussion on the film set with Jill, was you're actually acquiring a whole new skill set, completely different to how you were trained to be a paramedic. You're literally learning how to do other things, right? But I've actually seen more skills decline in busy cities in ambulance services where they're going to lots and lots and lots and lots and lots and lots and lots of jobs, but they're not actually jobs they've got to intervene in. They're communication, they're talking, they're driving. So there's actually a lot of skills decline there. So I think regardless of where we work, I mean, what I discussed with Jill too, she said, would you suffer from it? I said, absolutely. Absolutely. I haven't had to cannulate someone in probably 6 months. Therefore, I need to practice that skill, because regardless of where I'm going to work, if I'm carrying IV drugs or IV fluids, that is a skill I need to be able to do.
So is the experience less about the whole job, more about the skills involved in the job?
Well, each job has certain skills that are required. And this is why I say, like, the drugs is one of those, it's one of those kickers where just because you're not carrying it doesn't mean you're not a paramedic. And if you're in an environment where it's not available, it's not something you should worry about. I've transitioned into so many different jobs over my career. And I say that with a smile on my face, because it's been dynamic, interesting, and fun. But there's so often I have to start studying again to enter into a new job. So bring up April, for example. I'm going overseas to swim with some shark experts with great whites. I have got to get myself back up to a very high standard for trauma care. I haven't had to deal with that for a long time, but catastrophic trauma care. So I'm spending the next few weeks reading, practicing, and training. When I come back from that, if I'm not entering that kind of sphere or that kind of space, I'm not going to maintain those skills, because I'm probably not using them. Mm-hmm. So I think there's no, like, you can't stay on top of absolutely everything. You've got to accept that it's a waveform of your career.
Mm. And ride the wave.
Ride the wave. Right. Well, I mean, we're doing a clinical symposium. We ride the lightning. It should have been ride the wave. But there have been times that I've operated at almost as low as an EMT level because that's what the job prescribed. That's what it required. And then there's other times that I've worked in a flight role at an ICP level.
Do you think, Lou, that there's this misnomer?
Misnomer.
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 With an N.
Not
no T.
It's a woman. Controversial.
Do you think there's a misnomer that we should be at that high standard all the time?
Yeah.
Well, she's there. She's there because these people are being failed in their courses for mistakes that paramedics are making on the street every day,
man,
not losing their jobs.
I fail all the time. Mm.
They are held to such a high standard.
Yes.
Now, whether we agree with that or not, but she is held to that standard that you and I are referring to.
Mm-hmm.
And she's held it for how long now?
3 years.
How much longer?
7 months.
No one's counting.
When you first qualified, Nick, were you at the peak of your clinical game?
Are you ready to unlock exclusive content and take your paramedic journey to the next level?
We know that staying ahead of the curve can be tough, but that is why we created our membership program.
The Shift Extension Membership, where you'll gain access to premium resources, expert insights, and a community of like-minded individuals.
Enjoy early access to new content, exclusive events, and personalized support. Plus, get discounts on our training days and symposiums.
Join today and start achieving your goals faster. Visit our website or click the link in our show notes to sign up now.
I think, like, academically, your knowledge was really good, but you didn't have the experience.
The application?
The application wasn't there, but I don't think you need it though.
Mm.
Well, I think it adds value to it, but it's what you do with those experiences.
Mm.
So there's this idea that you can repeat, you can have 20 years of experience, and that could be 20 years of experience, or it could be 1 year of experience repeated 20 times. So people go, oh, you need to have exposure and need to see things in order to be better or to be competent. Well, I disagree. It's what you do with those experiences that is really how it changes and influences how you grow as a clinician. Mm. So you could go to one cardiac arrest every 2 years, but if you took that cardiac arrest and you unpacked it and you debriefed it and you went and read about things and you took some skills out and then went and did some mindfulness stuff, you're going to be a far better clinician than the person who did 8 cardiac arrests and went, oh, that was fun. Next.
Mm. Ooh.
Mm, that's true. Interesting.
Have you heard of this visualization concept?
Enlighten me.
So there's this thing in psychology called visualization, and it's essentially where you close your eyes and you visualize yourself doing a task.
Mm-hmm.
It's used in a lot of high performance teams, so F1 drivers, aerobatic pilots. Essentially, you sit down and you go through and you create that imagery in your mind of what you're going to do, and you rehearse it. And there's some research out there that suggests that this visualization is as good as physically doing the task yourself. And it doesn't require a simulation. It doesn't require you to go to the patient. It doesn't require you to have mannequins or consumables. You can sit down and get a learning outcome from simply closing your eyes.
The question was, can training replace experience then? That was the question that generated this discussion.
Correct.
I think we've accepted that experience is a difficult thing to define.
Correct.
And even if you're receiving that experience, if you don't have time to reflect on it, it's not going to be as powerful of experience as if you had time to actually properly unpack, reflect, and revisualize.
Mm, yeah.
Do you think, Lou, that you're at university, how many non-jurisdictional ambulance skills have you learned at university?
I didn't learn any in mine.
Mm.
It was all...
It's a safe place, Lou.
We do community paramedicine, so we learn how to do different assessments without...
Who's teaching it?
Doctors.
Oh, yeah?
That's good.
But amazing doctors, I will say. So we are doing stuff like that. I can't talk on behalf of any other universities, but we are at least doing that. But majority is...
It's not a criticism. It's just not... It's
I guess like
an observation.
Yeah.
If we only learn traditional jurisdictional ambulance skills, then we value those skills as the skills and exposure of a paramedic.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're not getting those skills because your work environment doesn't have them, but they're giving you new skills, we're not recognizing those new skills as new experiences.
Mm.
Like, for example, like if I went to Nepal, I wouldn't take S8s, but I would need the skill to be able to negotiate to get a donkey to extricate someone because there's no roads.
Mm-hmm.
The jurisdictional ambulance service doesn't do donkey negotiation.
Not yet.
Right? Not yet.
It's also a hard thing to bring into a university program, but we've been taking university students to these places to get this exposure, and they have been having life-changing experiences.
100%.
You should come, Lou.
Yeah, I'd love to. I would love to negotiate.
Just disclaimer, sometimes you don't get to shower for 5 days.
That's fine.
Okay, good.
11 days. I've never loved a shower so much in my life.
Nah, good deal.
But I think, yeah, we're too caught up on the ambulance stuff.
Yeah.
And we're just neglecting all these new skills that people that work in other environments have. Like this Jill who works on the movie set, she would have amazing skills that she would never develop from an ambulance service that are fantastic that maybe she's not valuing.
Yeah. Look, ironically, Jill had an incident not too long ago where she was asked to come and strap someone's ankle. Have you been taught how to strap ankles?
No, sir.
No. I'm number two.
Well, maybe, but no.
There's a lot of programs in the country that will not include
like
strapping.
Like sports strapping.
Yes. Yes. But when when you have an environment where a paramedic is employed as the subject matter expert for health and medicine, the expectation from everyone there who is non-clinical is this is our clinical expert.
Mm-hmm.
Therefore, anything clinical will be expected of that person. And so when they discovered that she didn't know how to strap an ankle, they actually replaced her. So this poor
Jill,
registered paramedic, actually lost her first job because the degree that qualified her didn't include something that is expected in the private sector. Now, she's done exactly what I'd hope she did. She has gone and learned how to strap shoulders, knees, ankles, and she has bounced back to another job.
Amazing.
It's a pity that this isn't filmed because I would love to have captured Lou's face when you said she lost her job.
But let's just focus, let's spotlight that on a second. Someone has, you were talking about it before, paid $30,000 to study to become a paramedic. They've then registered as a paramedic and got a job as a paramedic and then been dismissed by the employer because the paramedic standard that they expected wasn't met because it's been delivered from an ambulance perspective. It's a biased perspective they've been taught. Primary care is a paramedic skill set, and it's a growing paramedic skill set, and yet there's all of these gaps that we still have. She is a registered paramedic working as a paramedic, lost a job as a paramedic because there was a missing skill set. And I find that very interesting to unpack. There'll be people out there who say, yes, that's a physio's job. No, it's not. It's a health intervention by a healthcare professional. And if you're going to work as a paramedic, it is something you should probably learn how to do.
Okay. Noted.
In the private sector.
Yeah, I want to do private sector.
In the private sector. But you could have given her all the experience in the world.
Do you think, though, that we are bound by, like, rigid scopes of practice?
Well, what is a scope of practice?
Mm. It's defined by your employer, right?
Is it? Or is it defined by your registration? Because this is, again, that's a great question.
Mm. Yes, it is. It's defined by your registration. However,
everything will come down to your registration.
Yeah.
Right? You need your registration to work anywhere, but every employer can stipulate certain things.
Mm-hmm.
Now, your registration in about 16 very confusing paragraphs says that you can practice to the level you've been trained to do, but it doesn't stipulate what training means.
Mm-hmm.
So people will interpret that, I haven't been taught that in my degree, so I can't do it. But you can finish your degree and go and do a short course in something.
Yeah.
You could go do an ultrasound course and go buy yourself an ultrasound.
And it's not only part of your CPD.
Yeah.
But it's now an additional skill set. So if you work somewhere that gives you that range and scope, then you can.
Mm.
I want to do an ultrasound course, but they're very expensive.
Come to my work. Come on.
You could ultrasound a rat.
Oh.
What? No, we don't do rats.
Why are you ratist?
We are biased.
Why are you so ratist?
Ratist. Is that a thing?
Yeah.
It is now.
My wife is ratist. We had, because we were on an acre, right? We had rats. And so I bought one of those catch him
shotguns,
snare him and let him go. No, Shelly was beside herself. She's like, why don't you kill it? Because we're just catching it.
It's just out looking for food for its rat family.
Rats us.
Imagine sitting there and your dad goes out to get bread and milk and it never comes home. And mummy rat's like, it's okay, children. He'll come home soon.
And then mum gets taken too. And then you have all these orphans.
Little orphan rats. We've really digressed.
Wow.
you can ultrasound them. Anyway.
You can.
So go back to the original question. Do you think we're overthinking this experience thing, Lou?
Yeah,
and do you think absolutely. That we can replace experience with training?
We firstly, to answer your first question, I think we're overcomplicating it. Yes. Because it's relative to what you want to go and be as a paramedic. Like your skill set is relative to whether or not you want to be a mine paramedic or a retrieval paramedic or a film set. And then the second question was, what was it? This is a long time ago.
Can training replace experience? If you work in an area with limited exposure.
Yeah. Well.
Do you think you get the same outcomes from training as you can experienced?
If you couldn't.
What were the
then the
options?
Space programs wouldn't work.
Yeah.
Because
well,
they
the military wouldn't work.
Exactly.
That's another really
pilots.
Good example.
How many pilots use simulators?
We trained for years.
Can't be like, engine failure, it's fries.
Yeah. Yeah.
So the notion that, you know, experience is the be-all, end-all, I think is a misnomer.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's misunderstood. I think it's from a biased pedestal that people are looking down on people to egotistically bring themselves up. But you're right, the military wouldn't work if you couldn't replace experience with training.
How many good soldiers did you work with that had never fired their weapon in?
Hundreds.
So why are we so caught up?
Who had never
it?
Been to war zones, who had never been deployed to peacekeeping missions, hundreds of extremely competent, good soldiers who could do their job. The space program is full of astronauts who've never been to space. And every time they go, they perform their duties. Well, I mean, you've got to be perfect up there or you don't come home. So to perfection. Whereas paramedicine is very hung up on this notion of you must have experience and lots of exposure to be a good paramedic. And it's utter rubbish.
Mm.
Utter rubbish. If you maintain the skills that you need to do your job,
mm-hmm.
when the call comes or when the time comes, you will be able to use those skills and gain experience.
Mm. Well, what do we do at uni for 3 years? It's all training.
Yeah, but you're just a student.
Oh, thank you for that reminder.
I
know my place.
I hate that phrase.
So do you think, and then the next question goes, because I can hear our listeners going, yeah, but there's no training opportunities out there. Do you think the onus is on the employer to provide those training opportunities?
Not according to your national registration.
Mm, it's up to you.
It's totally up to you.
Yeah.
Now, we recognised there was a gap, and so we started our own platform to provide training. Now, you've got to be careful there because that could be cowboy, cowgirl. You've got to structure these things professionally appropriately. But there is a gap out there for paramedics to obtain regular access to training, especially in the private sector.
Lou, do you think it has to be scenario-based training? Because this whole idea of like high-fidelity scenarios being the closest comparison to a real patient, does it need to be that to get good outcomes, do you think?
I don't think so. I think you can replicate that in other ways. Whether it be through what you suggested before, visualizing, talking it out with someone else, talking the scenario out with someone else, or like research, like learning about it. But do you disagree with me? What was that?
Oh, I agree with you. Because there's not a lot of truly high fidelity.
His face looked like he disagreed.
Yeah, I was like, oh, okay, noted.
Because really, the simulations we do at university and even in the ambulance and other areas, it's not high fidelity, it's low fidelity, right? You still got that simulatus aspect of it where you're talking to a plastic mannequin going, what do I see, hear or smell? What is the nature of the skin? And someone with a clipboard gives you an answer.
As you find it.
As you've learned it.
I don't know how I find it because I can't see it.
Exactly.
Why is paramedic training aligned to what you're describing right now? Why are we laughing about this? Because it's true.
Because that's what we've always done.
But why? Why has it not improved?
Because we think that it works.
Remember a couple months ago, I went to the Qantas Sim with one of our colleagues, took me into that aircraft. It felt every single bone in my body felt like I was on a plane flying down a runway. It felt like we were flying. It felt like we were landing. Every single aspect of their job is simulated. Why are we exposing our colleagues to such poor simulation?
Have we proven that better simulation creates better outcomes?
So I hate to use aviation repeatedly as an example, but they moved into the human factors and crew resource management 40 years ago because I had too many planes being flown in the ground with a co-pilot who knew what was going on, right?
That didn't speak up.
They had to change the way they train their pilots. They had to change the culture of the profession from the top down. So I would say there are very proven and demonstrated applications of higher simulation create better outcomes.
Oh, 100%.
Why then are we performing such poor and low levels of simulation? And it's across the board. It's not just at universities.
Oh, no.
It's across ambulance. I mean, how many training rooms have you been in ambulance services where there's a naked mannequin on the ground with tubes hanging out and a bit of gear?
Because that's what we've always
done. That's what we've always done.
And a bed.
And then you're going to get someone who's going to come and sit and just assess you right there. And what's the patient's blood pressure at 90 over 60? What's their allergies, GT? Like, that's going to prepare you only to a certain point, but it's certainly not going to prepare you for what you're going to...
Well, there was a really good high-fidelity simulation centre in Brisbane that unfortunately shut down, and it shut down because they couldn't get buy-in, both from individuals but also large organisations.
So and, that comes down to funding, right? The organisations wouldn't fund it, but that goes back to your original question, whose responsibility it? Hate to say it to everyone out there, the responsibility for your training and development comes down to you as the registered professional now. So you can cry all you want to the businesses that employ you, the companies or the services, but it's actually not their prerogative and it's not their responsibility to ensure that you maintain your skills. Mm-hmm. Their prerogative is to make sure that they protect you and serve you to do your job. Your job is to maintain CPD and continue to develop.
Mm-hmm.
Controversial.
Oh, mate, that means you've got to pay for it.
What?
That means you, as a professional person, have got to pay for your own development, your own CPD. So sim centers like that one were targeting services and things like that where there's, you know, a lot of money, but they weren't going to spend it.
It was great. The stuff they were doing was unbelievable.
That training absolutely replaced experience. I learned a lot there.
And but if you don't want to spend money on training, there's so much free stuff out there online. Mm. YouTube's got plenty of stuff. Mm-hmm. We've got some stuff. Mm-hmm. Costs a little bit of money.
Mm.
But that just helps us keep going.
Mm-hmm.
But there's lots of stuff out there. And this whole, like, look up some visualization. I'll find some papers.
Visualization is a really, really powerful tool for not just reflecting, but also developing concepts in rehearsal. Interestingly, I didn't coin it as visualization, but I was talking to Jill about it at the film set because we had 12 departments working on top of each other there. It was a three-story structure built on a muddy foreshore with plant equipment and explosives.
What could go wrong?
What can go wrong? There's only two medics there too. And I mean, my approach to this kind of thing is, one, accept I can't manage everything. But two, how am I going to prepare for this? And it's visualizing. And I literally said to Jill, do you use the top three model? And she'd never heard of it before. The top three model is what I use for just about every new situation I go into. What are the three most possible things or likely things that are going to happen? Mm-hmm. And what are the three most catastrophic?
Death.
Well, what kind of death, though? Like, what kind of incident is going to happen based on what's there? And if you can literally visualize the three most catastrophic things that you think could happen there and rehearse what you're going to do, you're actually preparing yourself for the inevitable. And then if you can also identify the three most likely, well, that's probably what's going to keep you the busiest.
Maybe we could find a paper on visualization and include it in our paper series.
Ooh.
Pre-hospital papers pertaining to paramedic practice.
It is powerful, though.
Hey, this has been a good podcast, but it's lunch.
Oh.
And there's a lizard outside I'd like to go look at.
What? Sonny's left the building.
Sonny's... That's the baby one. Sonny.
Sonny, we're still recording, mate.
Sonny's...
It'll still be there. It lives there.
What's his name?
Just... You're going to break my door. It's got a deadlock on it. Well, Sonny's left the building, so thanks. Just you and I, Lou.
Yep.
Thanks for listening to this episode. Can you shut the door for the cat? No.
Never mind.
Wrap it up, Lou.
Thanks so much, guys, for listening. Fuck. If you have any questions or concerns, write to us. Send us an email at hello@theshiftextension.org. We are on Facebook and Instagram, and we have Patreon. Thanks so much, guys, for listening.